66 to end things off here.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a peaceful homecoming at Queen's University.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
After an uncharacteristically quiet few weeks in the University District, the University District Safety Initiative has now been lifted, marking an end to what is typically the fall party season. Homecoming, FOCO, and Halloween all passed without much fanfare, prompting mixed reactions. For Bylaw and Kingston Police, the weekends were considered a success. Dan Hazel, supervisor of enforcement with the city, had this to say.
I'm really happy to report back to the community and the Queens community that this year's homecoming, the official weekend, was a very successful event. Very quiet on the enforcement end. There was really no hotspots of concern throughout the entire weekend. It was exceptionally quiet. It was nice to see the alumni back to our community. The oldest coat I saw was a 1972 alumni. Had a quick discussion on him, and it was really nice to see them come back to the community. For the second weekend, we did issue 13 penalty notices under the Administrative Monetary Penalties Bylaw, which is a very low number comparison to the last previous years. So I'd say that the second weekend was also successful. I think from my side of the table, I just want to give a huge thank you to all of our community partners, the Queen's community, Queen's University, Kingston Police, the police liaison teams, and to the enforcement officers that were all on duty for the event to make it as safe as possible.
Hazel attributed the success to the work done leading up to the weekend, particularly improved communication and outreach with students.
I think the main factors right now is the communication ahead of the events, exceptional coordination amongst the Queen's University community, the AMS, the Kingston Police and Bylaw Enforcement, really just to identify the areas or times that we might need it, using social media posts and getting the information out to the public on what the University Safety District Initiative is. All those efforts seem to be trending as a community in the right direction. And it seems that the events are now becoming less and less enforcement based and more community oriented, which we're very happy to see. So I suspect for the future, into the next years, we'd continue with those models, with the ultimate goal of having these events go off and no community safety concerns.
However, the biggest conversation among students and alumni wasn't about enforcement. It was about timing. Students and alumni continue to express frustration that homecoming has been scheduled during reading week in recent years, saying the shift has made it difficult for current students and returning grads to connect. Queen's undergraduate student Hannah Harrison voiced that feeling in a video posted on TikTok.
I think Queen's is absolutely diabolical for always making our HOCO on a day when it's our reading week and none of the students are here, and here's why. So yesterday, I was visiting a family member who it was their 20th reunion from graduating from Queen's. We were at the Queen's pub, and I went to the bar to get a drink, and there was a guy there who's got to be at least 85 years old. Okay, he graduated in like 1960. Okay, so do the math. And he's looking around, he looks kind of sad, and I was like, oh, hi, sir, like, are you all right? Are you looking for someone? And he goes, well, I'm looking for the students. Where are the students? And I said, well, it's our reading week. Like, nobody's really here. And he goes, that makes me so sad because what I look forward to the most about coming back to Queens is seeing all of you being so happy and having fun with your friends and reminding me of the best time of my life. So after my heart broke a little, I thought about it. And honestly, the whole point of Queens making homecoming on our reading week is so that we don't drink and party too much. Well, we just do it the next weekend anyway, so it literally changes nothing for us. However, it ruins the experience for the alumni who want to come back here and party like they're 20 again.
That sentiment has been echoed across social media by students and alumni alike, with many alumni saying they plan to include it in their feedback to the university. When asked about the scheduling choice, Queens responded in a written statement, quote, "The event took place on the third weekend of October, consistent with past years. Students continue to play an important role through volunteerism within their faculties and by supporting events, helping to create a welcoming experience for returning graduates," end quote. The university also noted that this year marks one of the highest attended homecoming weekends in recent years, reflecting a steady increase in alumni engagement over the past 3 years. Looking ahead, the 2026 dates are set for October 16th to 18th, once again landing at the tail end of Reading Week. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about an ongoing hospital funding debate in Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. As Gananoque edges closer to its next municipal budget cycle, a familiar question is resurfacing. Should local tax dollars be used to support area hospitals, or should those contributions remain a personal choice? Councillor David Osmond says he continues to support hospital foundations personally, but remains hesitant to back municipal funding commitments that would increase the town's tax burden. In a statement this week, Osmond said he recently received thank you letters from both the University Hospitals Kingston Foundation and the Brockville and District Hospital Foundation for his individual donation and encouraged residents who were able to do the same. The issue has been a point of tension for more than a year. In December 2023, Council voted against a proposed five-year pledge of $75,000 annually to support hospital upgrades in Kingston, citing concerns about the strain on local finances and arguing healthcare funding should fall to the province. Public backlash led Council to reconsider the matter in 2024, but in early 2025, Council ultimately opted for a one-time donation rather than a recurring commitment. Osmond said rising operational costs, provincial asset management requirements, and the town's upcoming transition to a strong mayor budget process all leave limited flexibility. Osmond emphasized he is open to continued discussion and recognizes the value of hospital foundations, but maintains that those able to donate personally should do so. "Anyone that is upset with my opinion on this can quantify that feeling and donate accordingly, knowing your neighbor may not be as fortunate," he said. The town is expected to revisit the funding question during its 2026 budget deliberations. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with his Queen's University sports report.
Thank you, Dinah. The Queen's Gaels men's football team was in action in Waterloo last weekend, looking to take home their first Yates Cup in nearly 16 years. The Gaels entered the game as the OUA's 4 seed, fresh off victories over McMaster and Windsor in the preceding weeks. They were matched up against the reigning, defending, undefeated 2024 Yates Cup champions, the Laurier Golden Hawks. These two teams had met earlier in the season at Richardson Stadium here in Kingston, a game Laurier won handedly by the score of 47-32. If there was any apprehension from the Gaels heading into this game, you could not tell, as they came out of the gates hot with an early interception from rookie linebacker number 30 Jacob Baldwin. That turnover resulted in a 14-yard touchdown pass from quarterback Alex Vraken to slot back Cedric Smith. Gaels draw first blood, taking a 7-0 lead. The next Laurier drive ended much the same as the last, with fifth-year defensive back Jared Seaway knocking a pass out of the hands of the intended receiver and into the hands of his teammate, linebacker number 44, Justin Pace. Two drives, two turnovers, both that resulted in points. Queens entered the second quarter up 10-3. Laurier would turn the ball over twice in the second, with Jacob Baldwin picking up his second interception of the game, running quarterback Cal Withers' pass into Laurier's red zone. Unfortunately, Baldwin would be injured on the play and did not return to the game. Alex Vraken scored his second touchdown of the game to put Queens up 17-3. The next drive, Cal Withers threw another interception, once again to Justin Pace, who would run that ball back for a touchdown. Queens entered the half up 27-3. Now, if the first half belonged to the Gales, the second unquestionably belonged to the Golden Hawks. Laurier slowly but surely chipped away at the Queen's lead, cutting it down to 17. It was 30-13 at the start of the fourth quarter. Laurier would score two touchdowns in the final quarter to cut that deficit down to just 3 points. But the Gales rallied late and held on thanks to outstanding plays from Stephen Capea, John Korskaden, and Jared Kasari. Queens wins 32-27, shocking the undefeated, top-ranked Golden Hawks and snapping a 16-year title drought. This is the 24th Yates Cup victory in program history. Queens will travel to Saskatoon on Thursday ahead of their Mitchell Bowl matchup with the Saskatchewan Huskies. The winner of that contest will advance to the Vanier Cup. CFRC's coverage of the Mitchell Bowl begins at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with kickoff scheduled for 3:15.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the possible creation of the Veterans Crosswalk in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council heard a presentation from a member of the public regarding crosswalks in honor of Canadian veterans. Isabella Harpel spoke about the sacrifices made by veterans and asked that council consider implementing these crosswalks throughout the township by next year. Harpel noted that recognition should extend beyond November 11th.
The world wars are a part of our history, and the men and women that fought and died should be remembered not only on November 11th, but through the year. We need to honor and prioritize the men and women that have sacrificed the ultimate by giving their life. We need to demonstrate to our courageous veterans that they are deeply appreciated and will always be appreciated.
Harpel went on to speak about the two new veterans crosswalks in Kingston and others popping up across the region.
From the research that I have completed just this past week, the City of Kingston will be placing the veterans crosswalks this year. The cost of the crosswalks range around $3,000. The City of Kingston, they purchase and the crosswalks themselves. Belleville, I spoke to Bill McDonald there. The cost for their crosswalks were $5,000 to $6,000. He couldn't remember exactly what it was. Their crosswalks were funded by community groups, and they were constructed and painted just prior to November 11th. And when I did research, there are many little hamlets that are now implementing this procedure of veteran crosswalks.
Crosswalks at the corner of Ontario and Lower Union Streets in Kingston were recently opened, along with a short ceremony. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend agreed that remembering veterans' sacrifices should extend beyond Remembrance Day on November 11th.
It's appropriate to remember the sacrifice of our armed services beyond the 11th, and we should try and do everything we can to honor the memory of their sacrifice and our duty to remember.
Council agreed to refer the matter to staff so they could review existing sidewalk replacement schedules and examine any other opportunities to install a veterans crosswalk in the township. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the fallout from the Auditor General's report on the Skills Development Fund allocations.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Ontario Liberal MPP Stephanie Smythe has written to the Integrity Commissioner to investigate how Minister of Labour, Immigration, Training and Skills Development David Pacini administered the Skills Development Fund. The Auditor General concluded that Pacini's office was not transparent in how it awarded proposals.
I filed the letter with the Integrity Commissioner, the request on Friday, and formally asked the Commissioner to investigate whether the Labour Minister, Mr. Pacini, violated the Members' Integrity Act or breached parliamentary ethics in his handling of the $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund. And I made it clear that this isn't just about who the minister is friends with. I'm sure you might have heard this discussion going on, but the issue is whether he used his public office to benefit that friend, friends, and clients in ways that might have broken the law. And we know, Dan, that the Auditor General has already found that the Skills Development Fund was not fair, transparent, or accountable. And now we're asking the Integrity Commissioner to determine whether the minister's conduct, you know, crossed ethical or legal lines, and whether he advanced private or political interests, or gave preferential treatment to insiders, or breached conflict of interest provisions under the Members Integrity Act.
Now, there is a photo of Mr. Pacini at a hockey game with his wife and an apparent person that was interested in the Skills Development Fund, and he's also admitted to going to a wedding in Paris. Do you believe that this is a pay-for-play situation?
Well, we believe it certainly is. And here's what we know. And I don't know if you saw our board, Dan, that we used yesterday. I have a TV background. So we just created this board that sort of shows a web of connection in this circular economy of donors giving money to the PCs and then the conservatives giving the money back, you know? So it's just this intricate web, and it's a web of connection. So what we know is lobbyist Michael Rutterham, a longtime personal friend of Minister Pacini's, secured more than $8.5 million in public funding for his clients through his program, including $7.5 million for Keel Digital Solutions, and then $1.2 million for Life Labs. Now, Rutterham's lobbying registrations for both companies were active when these funds were approved. And then Mr. Pacini personally intervened on Keel's application, and its project public servants have ranked really poorly, and then later admitted that his office overruled that internal evaluation to turn around and fund lower-scoring projects that, you know, aligned with government priorities. And he even named the Keel project on live radio as an example. And a year and a half before that, you referenced this hockey game, the minister was photographed sitting, yes, rinkside at that Leafs game with Peter Zakharov, a Keel director. And we now know that those are Zakharov family seats, right? And within a year, Keel's low-ranked proposal received millions in public funds. So, and then as the Auditor General's report was released in October, the minister appeared remotely from Paris, later confirmed to be attending Mr. Rutterham's luxury wedding at the Four Seasons, a lobbyist whose clients had, you know, again, benefited directly from his ministry. So taken all together, Dan, these facts paint a really disturbing picture to us, a minister using public power to advance private connections. And we believe that Ontarians deserve better. They expect that their public dollars will help workers and employers and not the donors and not the insiders. And that's the way the Skills Development Fund was supposed to build Ontario's workforce and not, you know, bankroll political friends.
Now, there's two kind of, if you separate that, there's two issues here. There's one with how the Skills Development Fund was used to rank lower projects and how those were used. Now, Mr. Pacini has defended that and saying that these projects, while they did rank low, they did help people get into skills and jobs. So it was kind of doing what it was intended. But the second issue is the perception of what you've brought up. So are you... in favor of, I know you kind of brought this up in terms of wanting him to be resign or quit. Are you asking him to resign over what he's done with the program low ranking proposals, or is it he's got a perception of giving money to his perceived buddies?
Well, it's, you know, all of the above is disastrous. Listen, you said the program worked, but it didn't, right? In fact, you know, they did not give to the highest ranks for whatever reason. And we don't know what the ranking criteria is, right? So this is all leading to, we think he should be fired immediately by the premier calling on that, right? So we don't know that, and they're not even tracking who got what job, right? And where the money has gone, exactly why it's gone there, and what exactly has been the outcome of these hardworking Ontarian dollars, right? They're not, we can't even be told by the government that these are full-time, part-time, or temporary jobs. So there's absolutely no accountability.
Now, in terms of yesterday when you brought this up on Monday, the Abacus poll came out and it believed that more than half the respondents suggested that Mr. Pacini resign or quit or be fired. But 57% of the respondents didn't quite know what the controversy was. How much weight do you put into this poll?
think like any poll, you know, you look at the margin of error, you look at the number of people polled, but the fact of the matter is it's an abacus data poll. And we look at it, we think, you know, from our perspective, people are watching. They're starting to catch on. I know it's very, very easy to get distracted by a premier who pours out Crown Royal or who eats an ice cream bar or talks about feed cameras to make us look over there at this bright, shiny object. Meanwhile, you know, they're tabling omnibus bills that have horrible impacts on renters, et cetera. People do care, bottom line, about where their money goes. And what we're doing is showing that. We're displaying that on our web of connections. We're going to not stop talking about it and not stop holding this government to account.
Representatives for Puccini did not respond to a request for comment. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. And a hearty congratulations on behalf of CFRC 101.9 FM to Jesse Bell upon calling his 50th Gales football game on CFRC radio during the Yates Cup last weekend. Best wishes to him as he journeys with the Queen's Gales this weekend to Saskatoon to cover the Mitchell Cup national semifinal game as the Gales face off against the Saskatchewan Huskies at Griffith Stadium. Now over to Jesse with the weather.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, November 13th, daytime high of 7 degrees with a little wet snow in the forecast, but we're talking less than a millimeter or so. It's going to feel closer to 2 degrees, very chilly, very breezy day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, November 14th, we're going to have the holdover from that Thursday squall, some trace amounts of freezing rain, once again, less than 1 millimeter in terms of accumulation, and that'll be in the morning before warming up a little bit and clearing into the afternoon. Saturday, November 15th, daytime high of 3 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, November 16th, daytime high of 5 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation in the forecast, dropping down to 1 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, November 17th, daytime high of 5, a mostly cloudy day here in the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that the LaSalle Causeway will be closed on November 16th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., so that's closed for all vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel. Here are some relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed for construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed for construction activity and staging at 484 Albert. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne closed for construction activity at 283 Queen. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, closed November 12th at 8 p.m. to November 14th at 8 a.m. for event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, closed until November 21st for gas main installation by Utilities Kingston. Raglan Road, Division Domain, closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for a gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, closed until November 28th for installation of new water, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Hey, this is Nate Bright, co-producing of this year's CFRC live sessions and release reading reels on Instagram. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make a gift today via CFRC.ca.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Bad Dawn, a new single by local act Lake Porter. The new song is about facing the impossible and surviving it with the people who never leave your side. It's a story of loyalty and defiance, staring down darkness and choosing love anyway. As faithful as the sun to a new dawn, it's a reminder that no matter how bad it gets, we rise together. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Bad Dawn by Lake Porter on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
All night, it gets a little brighter. All day, it gets a little dark. I don't want to drink every day, it just feels the same. I pour my last shot right down the drain, and maybe I'll find my sanity. And oh yeah, it's right in front of me. And this time I had it all wrong, but the good day's gone and the bad day's dawn on me.
I'm way too comfortable living a lie. Swore to myself a thousand times.
Jack Ayala, one of CFRC's marketing assistants at the station. CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, donors also earn one more ticket for each of our weekly raffle draws, featuring prizes from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long M. McQuaid, Mighty Birds, Pope Works, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating and give today via CFRC.ca.
Had a 6 transistor when I was a kid. Under my pillow, I kept it hid. When the lights went out and no one could see, over the airwaves the world came.
Hello, friends and listeners of Way Back with Johnny. This here's your old host with most country western music and bluegrass music, Johnny Woodlock. I'd like to invite y'all in to join me and my furry companions, Simbush and Gunny, every Sunday morning from 8 to 11 as we bring you 3 hours of only the best in country and bluegrass music, also including special interviews. This is where the legends of country music and bluegrass live.
I watched it all on my radio.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. This is episode 10 of season 3 and we are diving into some Olympic news for Team Canada, and we're going to take a look at some of the Hockey Hall of Fame inductees. It was kind of a busy week, and then we're going to go through some of the standings and biggest headlines over the week. But let's start off with the Team Canada Olympic roster. Kyle, I know you wanted to talk about this. You sent over this very handy chart of showing who's in, who's out, and who's on the bubble. Anyone that surprises you right away, first look at it. Sam, did you take a look at that too?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
All right, Kyle,
I mean,
what do you
one thing I would say that's pretty notable right away on that chart is that they've ranked Macklin Celebrini higher than Bedard. I thought that was interesting. Substantially higher too, because he's a tier above him in their ranking. Another thing that's interesting, I mean, eventually enough people were complaining how ridiculous it was that Logan Thompson wasn't being put on the roster. That looks like that some of that's getting through.
Yeah.
So looks like there's a pretty decent chance he'll be part of the team.
Yeah, they said that Binnington's the only lock on this chart, which, I mean, I don't know. The way Binnington's been playing this year, I don't know if I want him as my starting goalie, but he does have the credentials to back up his poor play, so I understand why he's a lock. But yeah, I'm happy to see Thompson is on there as someone that's most likely going to be at least the number two goalie for Canada in the Olympics.
Yeah, I honestly, Binnington's kind of like one of those. Like, he's clutch. Like, you know what I mean? Like, in the, when it counts, he's actually, like, really good. He's the direct opposite of Connor Hellebuck. Connor Hellebuck is consistently great. You know, Binnington maybe not so much, but when it counts, he shows up. So,
yeah,
he's got that going for him.
No, I like to see that. And I did see that they have a bunch of goalies down there on the bubble. For the third string. And I found that surprising too, because I remember when they did their training camp a couple months ago, they only invited 3 goalies, which was like the least out of all of the countries that hosted training camp. They invited Montembeau, Hill, and Binnington were the only goalies invited. So now it's nice to see that there's going to be some competition for that third spot. I think because the Olympics is a longer tournament than the Four Nations, the last few Olympics we've seen at least 2 goalies play for Team Canada. One's involving NHL players, that is. But I remember in 2010, Marty Brodeur was like the starter at the beginning, but then Luongo kind of took over. And then 2014, Price was starter for most of it, but I think Luongo also played. So it will be interesting to see the combination they go with here, because there's honestly times where you probably don't have to start Binnington every game if you're playing a weaker opponent. But yeah, no, it's nice to see that there's some goalie depth going on for Team Canada. I know that's definitely their weakest spot. It's kind of been their weak spot for a while. But everywhere else, man, I got to say, this is an insane team. I don't even know how you choose players for this. This, like, the defense and forwards, this is going to be one of the best Canadian teams that I think I've ever seen skater-wise. Sam, anyone on offense or defense that piques your intrigue?
Okay, well, I think first we should explain to the viewer who can't see this what is going on in the chart. Mm-hmm. There's a few different categories for forward and for defense and goalie. There's the lock category, which in other words means people are locked in. They're 100% making the team. Then there's the near certainty category, the inside track category. And then there's bubble guys tier one, bubble guys tier two, bubble guys tier three, and bubble guys tier four. Mm-hmm. I kind of mostly agree with it. The only thing I disagree with is that I think Bedard and Celebrini should be near certainties with how well they're playing right now. It'd be crazy to me not to let those guys play just because they're young. Yeah. They're still better than most of the players on the American national team and pretty much all the players on the Swedish and Finnish national team. So, yeah. I mean, okay, like, look, that's kind of a bold thing to say. And obviously it can be refuted because experience brings a lot of talent. Mm-hmm. But I do think those guys are really good. I also think that Scheifele is kind of disgusting. And I don't really understand how he's not on the same level as Brad Marchand to these Hockey Canada guys. Because Brad Marchand's on the inside track category. And Mark Scheifele is on the bubble guys tier two. To me, that's just absurd. I think Scheifele is absolutely repugnant on the ice. Like, the guy is so good that he reeks of stench. I guess that doesn't really make much sense either. But anyways, but you know, the hot take here, there's a goalie that's not on this list who would be really good.
He just
started playing again. He used to play for Florida and he took some time off. Or not Florida, Philadelphia, sorry. He took some time off.
Oh, my God.
I know we won't do it for obvious reasons, but he would be a phenomenal second goaltender.
I think that guy's going to get lit up in his first game in the NHL when he comes back after not playing for 2 years, but we'll see.
I got a feeling the crowd's going to be giving it to him if he's playing away. Any road game, I think he's going to hear it. Yeah,
there's no way on Team Canada. He's
a good goalie. He's a good goalie.
We'll see. We'll see how good he is when he comes back.
There's one other person I have to say. Wyatt Johnson's also been ridiculously good. So
yeah,
I would like to see him in there.
Sam Bennett off to a very slow start. He's only got 5 points in 16 games. Now he isn't known as the biggest point guy. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of him. I don't really think he brings much to the Team Canada. Now, I mean, I think he brings a lot to the Florida Panthers, and I think he was definitely crucial in them winning their two Stanley Cups. I'm surprised to see him under near certainty because I personally don't think he really brings too much to this team, and I think there's more talent behind him. I was also surprised with Mark Stone being on inside track. I think Mark Stone's kind of a guy that, like, yeah, sure, you want him there for leadership, but, I mean, I feel like the game is the international game's fast and Mark Stone, I don't know if he can still keep up, especially with him coming back from an injury, right? I know another guy I was surprised to see, not as surprised to see because he was on the Four Nations, but is Sorelli and Konechny. I think Sorelli's got that connection with who's the coach? Tampa's coach. What's his name? John Cooper. He's John Cooper. So Sorelli obviously is going to kind of be there because Cooper knows that he's good. I just don't see how. I don't know what world Sam Bennett, Mark Stone, Anthony Cirelli, and Travis Konechny are better than Macklin Celebrini, Mark Scheifele, and Connor Bedard right now.
Scheifele especially. Scheifele, this guy, he almost had. Did he have 100 points last season?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, like what? And he's a points leader right now too. So I mean he's been consistent. Yeah, kind of ridiculous.
He only had 87 last year, but that was his career best.
Okay. 87 though, that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I mean he's been consistent his whole career really, and honestly he's getting up to the age where he's been around too. Like so he like adds veteran presence. Like I would rather have Mark Scheifele than Sam Bennett on the team if I'm being completely honest.
I think my problem with Sam Bennett too is that he's if this was regular NHL style hockey, I actually would probably prefer Sam Bennett in there. Mm-hmm. But this is IHF, which does not allow for the same physicality at all. Yeah. So I think his utility is so much lower.
Absolutely.
In Olympic hockey.
Well, that's why I'm saying Mark Stone too, because bigger ice surface. I mean, like what is Stone gonna get gassed more than like Bedard and Celebrini.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I'd rather the young players because you kind of want the speed. But
exactly, like you're gonna give them more space to work with. Like, come on, I feel like those guys, like especially the way they've been playing. Like, if they weren't both top 10 in points, maybe I wouldn't be talking about them like this. But like, they're off to amazing starts. San Jose's on fire. Chicago's in a playoff spot. Like, it kind of makes sense that Celebrini and Bedard would be on this team. There's one guy that we haven't talked about. My guy, Nick Suzuki. I personally think he belongs on the fourth line. I think he deserves a spot the way he's been playing. He's a 90-point guy. It's pretty important to have. He's on track for over a point per game again this year. I don't know. What do you guys think about Suzuki?
I don't mind him on the fourth line. I mean, he's not, I wouldn't say he's like super fast or something, but you know, he's a decent player.
Yeah.
I don't think he'll end up on the team.
No.
One way or another. I feel like he'll just somehow not end up on the team.
I mean, especially since seeing who they've got ahead of him already. I'm like, clearly those guys are there because they've been bootlicking someone. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see who ends up on there, but
I mean, I feel like we're stuck in the, like, I mean, maybe there's some statistics that we're not seeing on this sheet that, like, you know, Travis Konecny is just ridiculous at some sort of back checking and some other like obscure statistics that I don't know, but
yeah, exactly.
Maybe there's something like that. But
and you know, I'm what? Sure. We're the outsiders. Hockey Canada always knows what they're doing. They are very credible. They definitely chose a great World Juniors team last year. Oh, so, yeah. I mean, I think we shouldn't even doubt Hockey Canada. all right, let's move over to the defense. We've only got four locks on here, and I was honestly surprised that Thomas Harley was a lock. I like Thomas Harley. But a lock. I was really surprised to see that. The other three are Makar, Morrissey, and Taze, which those three make sense to me. Even Taze, I mean, is a kind of like a hesitant on a lock, but I was surprised with Thomas Harley being a lock. Is that crazy to say?
I agree. I think the only lock here to me is Makar and Schaefer. No one else is a lock here to me. And Schaefer's not even considered a lock. He's bubble guys, all same tier. I don't know. You tell me he's worse than Pareko, Sanheim, and Doughty, and that he's worse than, okay, maybe he's worse than Morrissey's, but he's definitely not worse than Taze and Harley.
Well, with the defense, the thing is, usually, like, you can't account for, like, points. It's kind of irrelevant, mm-hmm. like, because there's only going to be one quarterback, and Makar is always going to be that person. Like, there's no one's contesting him for that. Well, I mean, on the power play, like, he's going to be the quarterback for every power play. That's just, there's no really change in that.
You know, when you have a second power play, would you not want a kid who's unreal at hockey to back you up and be the quarterback?
Oh yeah. Well, no, that's true. But I'm saying, like, someone like Evan Bouchard, to me, I just don't see him. Like,
no,
I don't even want him on that team because his value is so low, right? Like, you know, you've already got a guy that is a better, you know, better quarterback on the power play than him, and doesn't have the same defensive flaws. Like, the you know, the opportunity cost is not there for him on this team, honestly.
No, I completely agree with you. I was happy to see that he was on the bubble, because if he was anywhere above that, I'd be like, are you kidding me? That's a
I don't know about you guys though, but I couldn't help but notice that Darnell Nurse is nowhere on the list, and I thought that was absurd.
No, I can't believe that. Honestly, one that doesn't make as much sense to me is, I think Shea Theodore is a lot better than people give him credit for. I think
he is good. He's very good.
I would love to see him on the top six. I think he fits in there for defense, or not top six, sorry, the six defensemen that start. I hope if he doesn't get on that, I'm hoping he's a scratch, because he's a really talented defenseman that I think deserves to play in this tournament. That's kind of what we've been looking at with Team Canada. I mean, we already talked about one player that wasn't on this list at all, but is there anyone that you think that wasn't even on the bubble that kind of deserves some spots? I know John Tavares is on bubble guys tier four for offense. Now, that's going to surprise a lot of people, just with how he's been carrying the Leafs this year. Well, I mean, Willie Nylander is starting to pick it up too, but Tavares is having a great season, and he's like a guy that has a lot of veteran experience as well. He played in the last Olympics that Team Canada played in with NHL players. I was kind of surprised to see his name left off this list, especially in place of guys like Mark Stone, Brad Marchand, because I think Tavares is better than both of those guys.
I think Tavares, I wouldn't mind him on the team, honestly. I mean, but I don't think Mark Stone's going to play. He's still injured, yeah. But Mark Stone was insane for the, like, what, sixth game he did play this season, but he's just so injury prone. I mean, didn't he get, yeah, he got injured. Yeah, he gets injured all the time. So yeah, it's not really much of a lock on him.
Yeah, no, sadly, I don't think that's going to be, I don't think he's going to be able to get out there. But yeah, he had 13 points in six games this year. So that was pretty impressive. Yeah.
Not bad at all.
But do we want to move into talking about some of the Hockey Hall of Fame inductees? We got four NHL players out of the eight that were inducted. Zdeno Chara, Duncan Keith, Alexander Mogilny, and Joe Thornton were inducted. And then we had the other four were Brianna Decker, American hockey legend, Jennifer Botterill, Canadian hockey legend. And then we had, I believe, a coach or a builder, Jack Parker, and Danielle Savageau, which seems like a pretty decent class. I know from the NHL side, those are four great players that I definitely think are deserving. Alex Mogilny finally getting in. I mean, he's been retired for a while now, so it was good to see that. But, yeah, no, Duncan Keith, Zdeno Chara, Joe Thornton, no surprises there. Any surprises from you guys?
No, that's a pretty... Those people were all kind of locks on being in the Hall of Fame, I have to say. Not too many surprises there.
Well, I think the cool thing, though, is how fast some of them got onto the list. Like, Thornton's been retired for how long?
Only a couple of years, maybe 2 years. Yeah.
Yes, I'm pretty sure the average amount... If I'm not mistaken, this might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure last time I checked, the average amount of time it took someone to get added or inducted to the Hall of Fame was between 5 and 8 years. And yeah. I think Thornton only retired 3 or 4 years ago. He got on there pretty quick. And I think he deserved to get on there that quickly, too.
Yeah, no, he's super talented, was a great captain for the Sharks, great player for the Sharks. So it was definitely a good group of guys getting in. Chara, I feel like Chara was definitely a lock for just the longevity of his career too. But he also had that Stanley Cup, and then Duncan Keith had a couple cups as well. So very good to see. Happy, proud for all people that were inducted.
Well, actually, one thing, too, people forget about this. Chara wasn't just good at hockey, but he also just talked a crazy game. Like, he was on a podcast the other year, and he completely fabricated a story, as I would have done, too, about the guys in Vancouver practicing hoisting the Stanley Cup before Boston beat them in 2010, it was, I think. Anyways, completely made up, not remotely true whatsoever. Brought up on Hockey Night in Canada. I forget by who, but... I think it was by Kevin Bieksa.
Yeah, Kevin Bieksa.
Bieksa reamed him on the national television for a while. So, you know, if the Daniel Chara isn't there for hockey, he's definitely there for his storytelling. And I appreciate him for that because there isn't enough of that going around in the NHL.
No.
You know, every story has to have a bit of truth. And Chara's had a bit of truth in that there was definitely a practice. But what came thereafter was the most magnificent display of creative imagination. And for that, Chara definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Nothing wrong with that. Creative imagination keeps the journalism industry going, doesn't it?
According to the BBC, yes. But anyways, on to other things. You know, one thing we should talk about, I think, is Queens OUA football. They did pretty good. I'm not sure if you guys saw, but they are OUA champions. I think it was unexpected. Adam, you might know better than me, but from the last I heard, I don't think this team thought they were going to do amazingly this year, and they did pretty well.
Yeah, no, definitely this preseason projections were kind of similar, kind of Queens finishing third or fourth in the OUA, but they kind of lucked out as Guelph beat Western early on in the quarterfinals, so Queens didn't even have to go through Western. They did have to go through two other very tough teams, Laurier and Windsor. So Laurier was the defending champions from last year, and Windsor has been a consistent top three team over the past couple of years. So yeah, definitely a hard fought OUA championship for Queens. I think all it took was you guys leaving Queens for Queens to have a successful football team. So, now they're going. Now they're moving on to the finals, the U Sport finals. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Huge props to them winning the OUA championship. So Vanier Cup playoffs are coming up next. That will be really cool to see. We also saw the Queens cross country team won back to back U Sports national championships, so that's huge to see. My former team doing really well. They had a lot of great runs from a lot of great athletes, so really nice to see how well Queens athletics are going right now. Sam, you want to give an update on McGill athletics? How has McGill athletics been going?
Well, really putting me on the spot here. Sorry. Regrettably, there's not too much going on with McGill athletics. As per usual, it's a very academically inclined situation. But one thing I will say, credit to you folks at Queens who are avid listeners of this radio station and want to know what we have to say. You guys, Queens students and Queens alumni hit the gym way harder than do McGill active students. And it seems like more than, McGill alumni too. So, I can say that much. Unfortunately, the most interesting I know going on at McGill in terms of athletics is that the law volleyball team is pretty horrendous. One of the worst players on the team, I can say with great confidence and pride. Although, things are brighter on the other side of the grass, it seems. And Adam over there is not doing too bad himself in intramural. What is it?
Four ball and football. Yeah, we got those going. But I hear McGill had a crazy negotiations contest last weekend. That was pretty cutthroat. I heard second is the best somewhere. I think it was on my LinkedIn or something like that.
Yeah, that's the old saying.
Yeah.
But I will say one thing that is kind of cool, though, is that McGill doesn't really care too much about what's happening in their own sports, but they do care a lot about what's happening in the NHL. And just more general, I think we glazed Crosby a little bit last week, although I think we have to do it again because the Pens are unreal and Malkin's doing pretty well also. But on a very serious note, are you guys kind of surprised by what's going on with the stat leaders in the NHL and what's happening with the teams?
The one I'm surprised, I don't know if you've been seeing the Anaheim Ducks. I don't know what happened there. They're averaging 5 goals a game right now.
Yeah, Cutter Gauthier. It's Cutter Gauthier, man. He's insane.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that. 5 goals a game, though. That's something ridiculous.
Kyle, didn't you say a couple weeks ago that the Ducks like were unsustainable or something? Was that you or was that Nandez maybe?
I don't know if I said that unsustainable. I don't think they were that good a couple weeks ago. They yeah. weren't that great. They've gotten into this winning streak.
Yeah. No, they're doing insane. Yeah.
I still I don't know. I'm gonna say this. I still don't think that I see them going far in the playoffs. I'm gonna be honest.
Yeah,
they have a pretty good team though. Like, I mean, they've got a good goaltender. They've got a solid team all around. But I don't know.
Yeah,
I could be wrong. Maybe they'll win the first round in the playoffs. But there's some pretty tough teams. So
no, Anaheim's gross. And I think one thing with the Ducks too is, well, not just the Ducks, but the entire NHL. I mean, Detroit was so they were really good, doing really well, and now they lose 3 in a row and they're out of a playoff spot. Like, it's so early on that, like, you lose 3 games in a row, you lose like tons of spots, and like all of a sudden people aren't gonna be talking about you anymore. So Anaheim, I think, is like obviously off to an amazing start, but I mean, they ought to be able to avoid those droughts, because I agree. I think it's really hard to sustain this. I mean, we haven't really seen too many teams sustain. They got a 767 point percentage. Like, that's insane to be getting a point in 76% of your games. So I don't think that's going to continue. But I mean, I love to see rebuilds working. Big rebuild guy. So no, it's nice to see the Ducks finally getting some credit and finally playing some good hockey. I know there's a lot of good teams up there. Chicago now is it looks like their rebuild's kind of paying off. Utah's rebuild looks like they're paying off, although they lost Montreal and Ottawa, I believe, in this last their last two games. So those are two other rebuilds, Montreal and Ottawa, both in playoff spots right now. And I mean, maybe Boston's even done a quick rebuild and all of a sudden back up to being good again. But I think Boston's kind of more of a fluke to start, at least.
I mean, I think the thing I'll say about the rebuilds, one of the reasons why they're doing so well right now, I have to say, is a lot to do with the cap changes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, if you're a new team right now, that's rebuilding and all these cap changes are coming in, like you have so much mobility with new players to acquire, whereas like other teams that have like all these locked contracts that they're trying to like sustain and not trade, they're a little bit less mobile. But if you're willing to trade these old contracts, like you have so much more space to move pieces.
I agree. Yeah, I think we're going to see a pretty interesting trade deadline. I think when we get closer and closer to the trade deadline, it'll be cool to see if any big contracts get moved. One guy that I think is definitely getting moved is Steven Stamkos. I think that he is. I think Nashville's done with him. Honestly, I think the experiment in Nashville is over. He seems frustrated with the situation too, but I don't know. Any potential suitors for Steven Stamkos? I feel like he's got a pretty big deal, so it's not going to be the easiest one to move. But
they're going to have to retain part of it. There's no way they move him without retaining part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's a great team that would take him. It's just, again, money's an issue. Although I could see the Laval Rockets or the Belleville Senators taking him. But I just don't think this guy's an NHL player anymore, I'll be frank.
No, I think they're just not utilizing him properly. I'm going to be honest. I think they're trying to. No. It's kind of the similar thing that happened with Ovi, where like the Caps were not using him properly for a year or two there, because they were trying to make him play like how he used to be, where he was like a fast skater that could go back like end to end, and it's just not how it works. Like, you know, use Stamkos for his strengths. Like, he's going to be decent on the power play, but you can't be starting him in the defensive zone, have him skate a couple laps, and then hope he's going to clutch up with a nice shot. Like, he's probably gassed after that, right? So,
yeah.
Well, he is. I mean, he's 35, but I think there should be a rule in the NHL that states that the second any player is above a point a game and they're old and it looks like they're getting worse, they should be forced into retirement until they tarnish their points per game average. Because right now, Stammer's at 1,182 games played and 1,194 points. We should not allow him to play another 12 games. We should just send him down to the minors and let him have an untarnished over a point per game record. He's 35. In his profile picture for the NHL this season, he looks like he's had five sets of grandchildren, and he looks like he's raising them all. I mean, look, I love Stammer. I think he's an absolute stud. But he's just not the Stamkos who he used to be anymore. And we should not insult our Canadian heroes by trying to force them to play longer than they should. Everyone in the NHL should have sat down, all the GMs, and said, yeah, you know what, we're just not going to let Stammer play. We're not going to do that to him. We're going to let him leave with a glorious legacy. All the little kids who are just starting to play hockey would still think that he's good by the time they grow old. But, you know, if he's playing, like, Stamkos' generational legacy ends with this season, unfortunately. And I just think that's a gross injustice.
No, those are some hot takes, Sam.
I don't know if the situation is that dire. But the other thing is he went from playing with Kucherov and a pretty insane lineup of players. Like, Tampa just has way better star players than Nashville. Forsberg, in my opinion, was always kind of I don't know how to say, like an individual player. Like, he's a really good player, but he's kind of like, I don't know, he makes his own goals and stuff. Like, he's not really like a really good power play passer like Kucherov or something. Like, he'll score on his own, he'll make something happen, but he's not going to like, you know, break up the defense and give some perfect pass to Stamkos for a shot in, really.
No, I know what you mean. And another Nashville player that has to be getting frustrated is UC Saros. And I know a lot of Edmonton fans are hoping that maybe they can get in on the UC Saros sweepstakes.
Oh my God, that would be huge
for the Oilers. Finally a competent goalie, but he's been playing well this year too on, again, a rough Nashville team. Like, I think they've got to sell the team at this point. Like, they got to get rid of a lot of veterans on that team. And I mean, the only way, I mean, like you said, Kyle, like, the cap is huge right now, so it's a perfect time to start a rebuild. So, I mean, I think that
it's a seller's market right now.
No, definitely. But they're going to have a tough time moving all those contracts, because they got some guys on pretty hefty ones. I know Marchessault is on a pretty big contract. Forsberg's on a pretty big contract.
This is the other thing. I don't understand. Am I the only one that doesn't get, like, what the obsession is with Marchessault? Like, I just never thought he was that good of a player.
I mean, he played well in Vegas during that expansion era, but, I mean, I kind of know what you mean.
He played okay, but, I mean, he's not, like, I don't know. He's just not that good. Like,
yeah.
I feel like he's always, he's, I just think he's way overpaid. I don't know. I never thought he was that good of a player.
Yeah. No,
that may be so, but he does have nasty mitts, though. That guy's got some disgusting stick handling abilities.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
I can't say I've seen a highlight of his in a while, though. Like, has he, I don't know really, has he done very much with the Predators? I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, like, honestly, like, he's a solid third liner on a good team. Like, yeah. I don't, he just is not a first line player or even second.
Yeah, like, no. He had a 13-point drop.